I'm Emma Greed, host of Aspire with Emma Greed, a podcast where I sit down with people who don't just dream big, they build big. From culture-shaping voices like Mel Robbins to leaders redefining success like Tracy Ellis Ross to game-changing entrepreneurs like Mark Cuban, Aspire is about mindset, ambition, and doing the work that actually moves the needle. If you're ready to raise your standards and take charge about the life and career you're building, Aspire is where you start. Follow and listen to Aspire with me, Emma Greed, an Odyssey podcast available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey newsrooms across the country. I'm Christy Strausser, Odyssey's managing editor of news. Just off the bat, we'll say we tire of placing blame on young people for things beyond their control. It's tough out there to buy a house whether or not you eat avocado toast, and buying a daily latte should not cost your 401k. That being said, there are concerns that Gen Z is destroying the wine industry, and that's a trend worth discussing. Here's KCBS.
As young people reach for spiked seltzers and canned cocktails, or maybe don't drink at all, winemakers are fighting the perception that wine is for old people. Evan Goldstein, master sommelier, wine educator, and author, one of fewer than 300 people in the world to achieve the designation of master sommelier. And this headline screams at me, "For Gen Z, wine is an old person's drink." Is that the perception today?
I think in part that's certainly true. Gen Z has been a challenge. They've been a bit enigmatic during all this, but actually they're up a little bit. If you look statistically at what's going on today, millennials are the number one wine consuming demographic, which actually is new. It used to be baby boomers, I'm sure most of your listeners know, but millennials are now 31%, boomers are 26%, and while Gen Z is just 14%, if you will, that is up from 9% in 2024, despite the fact, if you actually look at the demographic, 50% of them are not even of legal drinking age yet. So while there is some challenges there, and while, yes, nobody wants to do what their parents did, nevertheless, I don't think we're going to throw the baby out with the bathwater yet.
I mean, I'm technically a young boomer. I'm doing the best I can, Evan, to try to prop it up. I'm doing the best I can.
Well, I think, and I'm right there with you, Steve. I think the challenge has been is that many of us who were of the boomer age, for health reasons, conflated with age, the fact that many people do have the luxury of having wine cellars and disposable income, we're all drinking a lot, but we're drinking better. So we're part of that demographic, not so much volume, but quality, and that's shrinking a little bit. But those Gen Z people are, it's interesting when you talk about them. I have a number of friends. My children have their Gen Z friends and their millennial friends and all that too. And I think a lot of it is how they get introduced to wines. You were absolutely correct in saying that if what's actually growing in the categories are these RTDs in cans. So, not that it's that hard to make a gin and tonic or a Negroni, but a lot of people get scared. So they'd rather buy one in a can pre-made. The convenience of purchase makes that also very interesting to them. And then bubbly is really the category that seems to be the most enjoyed by everybody, whether that's millennials, Gen Zers, boomers, whatever. I think people feel it's a celebratory in life where we're trying to look for celebration all the time. And people are not sitting there talking about, tannin levels and oak treatments when they're talking about bubbly. They're just sort of enjoying it.
Evan, I don't think a month goes by where we don't have a story on the radio here about a wine group closing wineries in the Bay Area, laying off staff. Set the scene for us. Where is California's wine industry right now?
Well, California's wine industry is not immune to the global wine industry. And if you look at the trends of what's going on with acreage diminishing, wineries having trouble, literally a shadow vintage in inventory between distributors and warehouses and in tanks and in wineries, there is definitely a glut out there. And I think anyone who is telling you the truth would be honest with you. Therefore, people are making cuts, and it's not just things that are actually on the verge of going bankrupt or whatever, but, even underperforming brands are cutting the number of offerings that they're having or cutting their losses, literally. I'm sure as you drive around, even in places as vaunted as Napa and Sonoma, you'll notice that certain vineyards are being either A, ripped out, or B, left fallow. And even, we were kind of blessed with a smaller, albeit fabulous, crop last year in 2025. That's a global phenomenon. And the big difference is that we get no support here in the United States, much less in the state of California, whereas you go to Europe and places like that, there are government incentives for people to either rip up vineyard, what they call grubbing up vineyard land, or if they're long on product, they can actually distill it into alcohol, which can be used for other purposes. We don't have that, which makes it even more painful.
Is there too much product for the demand right now, the old supply and demand concept?
I think so, but it really depends on where you look. Always at the entry level is going to be where the carnage is, because there's big pushes from people outside the United States, other countries in Europe, Australia, New Zealand, South America, who are fighting hard to gain traction in what is still, even with all of our challenges, the largest and most profitable wine market in the world. And a lot of that is going to come in at the more entry-level, lower price point. The premium end of the market, not necessarily those bottles that are, you know, $500, $700 a bottle, but let's say bottles that are more in that kind of $25 to $70 range, that's still a relatively healthy channel with people discerning, people who have that level of disposable income buying there. And overall, within the state of California, that is a very healthy place to be.
The podcast Campus Files is back with more stories of scandal, crime, and intrigue on college campuses. Campus Files, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Another great question here coming in: is the larger pivot away from alcohol altogether a cause for concern? And I guess maybe not just for wine, but what about breweries and what about distilleries?
Oh, no, that's a great question, Steve. You know, wine is probably one of the more visible lifestyle elements, but a beer, and specifically what we would call big beer made by the largest brewers in the United States, is having a tougher time than we are. Distillates as well are down, needless to say, having situations like tariffs, which diminish our exports, compounds the challenge a little bit. But no, it's a category-wide type of thing. And what we need to sort of do is pivot and try and understand, you know, what resonates with consumers, whether they're Gen Z, millennials, boomers, whatever, and meet them where they are and what's interesting to them. So, you know, the old school ways of doing things no longer work.
We'll follow that up by saying wine, like most things, is best shared. So why do Americans seem to have such a hard time getting along with each other? Here's Jason DeRuscia.
What is wrong with us as a society? Whoa, there's a big question to get us started here on Drive Time. It's Jason. And this isn't just some like goofy online poll. This is the Pew Research Center. 53% of Americans rate their fellow citizens as somewhat bad or very bad. Why do we hate ourselves so much? What happened? Ross, well, go ahead. You're on the air, Ross.
Yeah, I don't think they're morally bad. I just think they're getting information that's not true, and they're not getting all the information correctly.
So what do you mean by that? What is this political when you're thinking about that?
It seems like...
Do you think, though, like when you look around in White Bear Lake and say you had, like, you were stuck in a snowdrift, do you think you're, you know, would people stop to help, or would people just keep doing their own thing?
No, people would stop to help. I would believe that people would stop to help.
Yeah. It is interesting, like, how do we define the morality and the ethics of people? And I do think, Ross, you bring up a really good point, because the way that you're looking at this, I think maybe is the way that most people who answered the poll are looking at it, where you say, okay, if you support this candidate or that candidate, you're morally screwed up. Instead of just saying like, oh, we have a different opinion, it's more of an existential situation where you're like, you got to be a little messed up to be on that road, right?
Well, I don't know if it's that, or, you know, I got friends that I talk to, and I try explaining something to them, and they'll come back and say, no, that's not right at all.
Yeah.
And I'm going, well, I don't even know where you're getting that information from.
I know. Yeah, it is difficult to have conversations with people about fact-based things, because people have determined that, like, we all can have our own sort of fact. I don't know. If you were to ask me the very simple question, rate the morality and the ethics of people in your country, would you say it's very good, somewhat good, somewhat bad, or very bad. Politics, misinformation, MAGA, lefties, literally none of that would even cross my mind. Like, I don't think of any of that stuff as having anything to do with your personal morality or your personal ethic. And I do wonder if the fact, and I don't think Ross is at all out of the norm on how people think about that question. Maybe you do. Jason, most people aren't bad. They're just ignorant. Another texter, Jason, fellow citizens are not bad. They're just stupid. Jason, they're not bad. They're just misinformed and confused. What are we doing? Why is that the analysis?
Well, and what do you want to bet that of those three texts, you probably have
all different people, all different zip codes.
I'm saying, but at least two different vastly different political opinions.
For sure.
Maybe three, right?
Yeah.
And this is where, you know, when you and I were talking about this earlier, this is where I think this survey is an enormous red flag for this society. Because we've reduced people to either they're horrible human beings, or in this case, the texters, they're stupid, they're ignorant because they disagree with me.
Some are stupid, though.
Well, I mean, there's always been stupid people, though. That doesn't...
Right, of course.
We don't treat people... We haven't treated people in the past the way that we're treating each other now based strictly on political differences. That's what is really the through line in all of this, is if you disagree with me, it can't be, well, you know, you're a good guy, we just have different opinions. You disagree with me, you're a horrible person who's a threat to my existence, and you need to be destroyed.
Yeah.
We reduce people to these base level ideas that take away their humanity, and then we can just, you know, dismiss them all together. And this is, you know, I know people hate the both sidesism, but this comes from both sides.
Well,
one thing that doesn't get thought through enough is, let's say for a second, your opinion wins. What happens to everybody else? They have to just go away? They're not going away. If we don't figure out a way to see each other's humanity, to see the fact that we have more in common than we do that separate, if we don't find that, even when it's hard, even when we really violently disagree, if we can't do that, we are rude as a society.
Now let's wrap this in a giant red bow. Morality, alcohol, society. With a story about how the new weight loss drugs could be affecting all of those things. Here's KCBS.
Today, there is increasing evidence that GLP-1 drugs, things like Ozempic and Wegovy, may help fight addiction across every major substance. To break down what that could mean for addiction treatment, we're joined live on the KCBS Ring Central Newsline by Dr. Michael White, Distinguished Professor and Chair of Pharmacy Practice at the University of Connecticut. Now, some patients are reporting that they've lost interest in smoking and drinking after starting GLP-1 drugs for diabetes or weight loss. Can you draw a direct line between the two?
Yeah, so what they're starting to find is that, you know, the drug that they originally came out with for diabetes to help people control their blood sugars made people think less about food. So their infatuation or their cravings for food ended up going down along with their blood sugars, and that ended up causing weight loss. So the next big movement of these GLP drugs were from diabetes drugs into overall weight management, where you've seen there's been a lot of very positive data. And so now what they're seeing is that this reduction in people's craving for substances, not just for food, is also starting to occur. And what makes it very exciting is that it seems to happen across a wide range of different substances, from smoking to alcohol to opioids, you know, all of those types of things. Cocaine have all been associated with that also.
You know, that's really interesting. I always thought that the idea behind the GLP-1s is that it slowed digestion, food stayed in your stomach longer, and so you felt full longer, and so you ate less. But there's actually a brain connection here, you're saying.
Yeah, and so GLP-1 exists in two different places in the body, so your natural hormone. And the GLP-1 drugs are like a synthetic version of that that stimulate the same type of receptors. The GLP-1 that's in your GI tract sends a message up to your brain when it's stimulated that says, well, we're satisfied, we have enough food. But there's also GLP-1 that occurs in the brain, And these GLP-1 drugs don't only go into the GI tract. They all can also cross the blood-brain barrier, go to the brain, and they're around areas of reward and motivation. And what they're seeing in animal studies is that it dampens that dopamine surge that people get when they use a substance of abuse, and that seems to make it feel less pleasurable or less rewarding than it did in the past.
We've heard of a study of 600,000 VA patients that found 50% fewer substance use deaths among those taking GLP-1s. 50%? I mean, that's a big number. Is that enough to convince you that this is real?
So this is an observational study. It's a very high-quality observational study because they did a lot of things statistically to control for differences between those different groups and the people that were receiving GLP-1s versus the people that were receiving other diabetes drugs, what they call the SGLT2 inhibitors. But it's not a randomized controlled trial. Until we have all of that data, it's not going to be proven, but it's really, really incredibly positive, and it is bolstered by animal studies and then some small clinical trials only looking at tobacco use or only looking at alcohol. So I would say it's really, really promising, but at this point, it's not enough to be able to get a new FDA indication. But I know there's a lot of people and there's a lot of clinical trials that are currently ongoing. So within the next couple of years, we'll really have definitive information.
Now, touching on something that you referred to a few moments ago, people talk about losing food noise while they're on these GLP-1 drugs. The food noise vanishes. In layman's terms, can you tell us what is happening in the brain that makes people, you know, in the brain not want to eat more?
Yeah, so what's happening in the brain is that when you get a sweet treat or you make yourself eat until you feel like really full, some people get a dopamine surge that's associated with doing that. And that surge feels really good to them, right? And then when they don't have it, they feel a craving, like they really want to experience that dopamine surge again. And it creates this compulsion to do the same type of activity, to be able to give themselves that same type of effect over and over again. So that's within that reward center and that pleasure center, and that gets dampened when you're stimulating GLP-1 in that area, so that when you do something that's supposed to give you a certain level of additional pleasure, it's not as pleasurable for you as it was before. So there's less reason for you to do it. And that's kind of where the noise ends up going away for some of these people.
Yeah, that word compulsion, I mean, to me, that means addiction. So, you know, this really seems to work. It's fascinating.
Yeah. And so, you know, the one thing I would say is that when they looked at substance reductions, the people that were able to stop using these other substances, it really only went down by 13% to 20%. But the number of people that were binging on those that ended up in the hospital, ended up in the emergency department, ended up dying, or that their addiction was so bad that they thought about or they actually committed suicide was dramatically reduced by 26%, and then with the death figure that you said, up to 50% reduction in the number of deaths. So even though not everyone is able to kick the habit when they're using it, people may be less likely to have the kind of use pattern that's the most risky for their health.
So as we've talked about, it's shown in these observational studies that people lose interest in smoking and drinking. I mean, how far can we extend this? Could you extend it to gambling addictions, you know, sex addictions? Could it work on just about any type of addiction?
So it looks like right now it would be really promising to study those other things also, because they're all related to that same area in the brain. And it could even be for people that are addicted to social media, people that are addicted to you know, their phones, could have a similar type of impact. So the one thing that they don't know and that no one has studied is, you know, does it go to other areas of your life, that people who get really excited when they do something amazing at work, but do you really feel like you're going to do something amazing at work if you're not going to get that dopamine pulse, you know, when you crush your competition, when you land a big contract or something like that happens?
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask. I mean, okay, it can curtail addictions, you know, the smoking, the drinking, as you mentioned, social media, perhaps. But, you know, is it selective? Or, and because as you say, there might be things that we like being somewhat addicted to. We like getting fired up when good things happen at work, or, you know, we hit a home run in the softball game or something like that.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I think, we need to start looking more holistically at this drug, because it certainly is doing a lot more than just what's happening inside your GI tract, which is where they started. But I would say that not since Viagra. Remember, Viagra was originally started as a drug that was going to treat people with pulmonary hypertension, a very rare disease. And then they found that they had this side effect, which ended up turning into a $1 billion industry. This GLP-1 seems to have all of these other effects, and these other effects are really, really positive in a number of good ways. So, you know, should everybody be taking it? Should you be putting it in the water? We don't have that kind of information now. But for people who have high-risk diseases or disorders, whether it's obesity, whether it's sleep apnea, right, or if it's diabetes, or even, you know, perhaps now in addiction also, right, it's a really, really promising drug where the benefits should outweigh the risks for people who are at high risk of adverse events from those diseases.
You are listening to Ask an Expert on KCBS. I'm Steve Scott. We are talking about increasing evidence that GLP-1 drugs, things like Ozempic and Wegovy, can help fight addiction. We're talking with Dr. Michael White, distinguished professor and chair of pharmacy practice at the University of Connecticut. And we do welcome your questions. You can email us at askus@kcbsradio.com. How do animal studies for GLP-1 drugs work?
So what they do is they have animals that they get addicted to different substances, right? And then in the presence of a GLP-1, are they going back and are they self-administering as much as they did before, right? And so what they're seeing is that there's a curtailing where they're not as interested in going over and using those substances as they had done before. So even though it's still there, right, they're not getting the same pleasure out of it, which is what they anticipate, because they're going over and doing it less often.
Well, we're getting some really good questions in from our KCBS listeners. Here's one. What about the idea that we could have a drug that prevents addiction before it forms? In other words, before you start smoking, start drinking, start gambling or whatever, could it actually prevent it from happening?
If this ends up panning out in those clinical trials, the answer would be yes, right? Because it would be the same type of pathway. The first time you've done this, right, you get such this euphoric sense, or you get this burst of happiness associated with doing it, and then you want to be able to do it again. If you go into that experience and then you do it, and it's okay, it's pretty good, but it's not giving you that same type of jolt. Maybe you don't go back and do that again in the future.
KCBS listener Linda, you are reading my mind. I was just going to ask. Linda wants to know, if someone stops taking GLP-1s, do the cravings come back? Because we know weight returns after people stop taking it.
Yes, and that is the thing, right? Within 5 half-lives of that drug getting out of your body, the people are reporting that the same type of cravings start coming back. And they don't feel full, and they don't feel satisfied, and they start eating again in some circumstances, and then they regain all of their weight. Is there a benefit, right, for being on the drugs for, let's say, 5 or 6 years and then stopping and then slowly regaining the weight? The answer probably is yes, right, because you had the health benefits of not having that increased weight, but then you also didn't add more weight to that system. So it was kind of like a reset, but it is something that's only going to be working while you're actively taking the product. And even though the prices of these products have come down markedly, we're still talking about something that even with the best deals are going to cost you several hundred dollars each month in order to be able to get these benefits. So when you're talking about people who have high deductible plans, people that don't have prescription coverage, and a lot of people who have addiction fall into these categories, that's going to be something that is probably going to be out of their price range at this point, and the government's going to have to think about, you know, what are the societal benefits of doing something that's like this. So, for example, with opioids, they know that if you're addicted to illicit opioids, that it costs the universe, like the United States, between putting people in prison and taking away their children and all of the other societal benefits, that it costs several hundreds of thousands of dollars each year per person that's using illicit opioids, right? So maybe the cost of the drug pales in comparison to the societal benefits if you were going to be using those products. But that's something we're going to have to figure out, right? Because these drugs are much more expensive than things like methadone or nicotine gum, right? Or the other types of drugs for addiction we have now.
Hey, doctor, if I could ask to clarify something. You mentioned that the effects of the drug start to fade away after five half-lives. For those of us who, you know, biology and chemistry classes are a few decades in the rearview mirror, what's a half-life?
Yeah, so a half-life is the amount of time it takes for half of the drug that's in your system to get burned away. So remember that, you know, you're taking these drugs, you know, each week. And so that means that like a month later, you're probably back to where you were normally, right? The drug is now out of your system and the residual benefits are gone.
Okay, that's good to know. I appreciate that. Where does sugar addiction fit into this conversation? A sweet tooth?
Yeah. So some people are addicted to sugar in much the same way that people are addicted to other things like nicotine and alcohol. And it works through that same center that you have going on in the brain. So when you raise your blood sugar concentrations very quickly, some people get a dopamine release that's associated with that that helps to reinforce that sugar addiction.
We've heard that some people who take GLP-1s for blood sugar control could actually be on those for life. They're not there for weight loss specifically. I mean, it may be making them lose weight, but it's specifically to help with blood sugar. Could somebody who's trying to drop an addiction, could this be a lifelong GLP-1 prescription for them?
Yeah, it probably would have to be, right? Knowing what we know about what happens in terms of food addiction and how it comes back and that the cravings come back once the drug is out of the body, we would expect the same kind of thing.
I know GLP-1s are somewhat new. Is there research on the long-term effects of lifetime usage?
So we only know going out a few years what the long-term effects are. And, you know, they're generally pretty innocuous. The number of people getting nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and fatigue. Some people end up developing gallstones. Some people get pancreatitis, which is an inflammation of your pancreas. And some people get an inflammation of your liver. Now, these last things, these gallstones, the pancreatitis, and the liver inflammation, is because people are losing weight too quickly, right? So in some of those cases, they may be having problems because, you know, they're losing weight too quickly. They're on too high of a dose, right? And any type of very rapid weight loss can cause those same types of adverse effects. You know, some people don't like the cosmetic look of being on a GLP-1 when people lose too much weight, right? And then they get what they call Ozempic face or Ozempic hands and those types of things. But, you know, beyond the cosmetic aspects, the other adverse effects seem relatively innocuous. And then the more serious ones are still relatively rare. But we don't know what it's going to be like 10 or 12 years down the road when you have the drug on board for all that period of time. And we certainly need that information going forward.
We just have a few seconds left. Do you see a time when GLP-1s will be prescribed to help with addiction? And how far down the road might that be?
I do. And I think right now there's probably enough information that if people have tried standard options and the standard options haven't worked for them, it can be something that you could ask your doctor now if you could try. Maybe it's going to work, maybe it won't. I don't know if insurance is going to pay for it. Based on the data set that we currently have, they probably wouldn't. But if it is something that that you can afford, you should know within a few weeks whether or not the drug is working for you. If it's not, then you could stop it. But if it is something that's beneficial and is helping to get your life back, it may be worth that additional expense, right? And then when the clinical trials come out, it probably would be much more likely to be covered by insurance for those indications.
Well, this is fascinating.
Thank you for listening to On Deadline, your radio news from Odyssey. On Deadline is written and produced by me, Christy Strasser, and by Lauren Berry. Subscribe wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events. Major elections, world wars, scientific breakthroughs. But we also bring you into the smaller, behind-the-scenes stories. The unsung heroes, secret meetings, even personal grudges that changed the course of history. Listen to and follow History This Week, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with the History Channel. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.